The government is in the dock.
The landmark case being heard at the Supreme Court as the constitutional conflict provoked by the Brexit crisis reaches the highest court in the UK. 11 Supreme Court judges have started hearing two appeals to determine whether the Prime Minister acted lawfully when he suspended Parliament for 5 weeks.
Forget the dry technicalities. This is about power, how it is used and where it lies. Prorogation is just the tip of the iceberg. Senior government figures are refusing to even say that they will implement the new no-deal legislation.
If this legislation goes through Parliament, both Houses of Parliament, does the government abide by it?
Let's see what the legislation says.
Surely the answer has to be yes, it's the law.
Let's see what the legislation says. You're asking me about a pig in a poke.
So is this the new autocracy?
I think the position is irresponsible and elitist. The idea there's one law for Boris Johnson and his mates and another law for everyone else. It's appalling.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper from the LSE, and my co-host Zoe Williams from The Guardian. On today's podcast, we talk to Jolyon Maugham QC, a barrister at the centre of the prorogation case. He makes some quite startling revelations on the government's defence, or lack thereof, and is confident that the Supreme Court will find in his side's favour. With the judgment expected very soon, we get the lowdown on what it all means for the fragile state of Britain's democracy. To feed back to us on today's podcast, you can contact us on podcast@anothereurope.org or find us on Twitter @another_Europe. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please take a moment, as usual, to leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform.
Welcome, Jo Maugham, the star of this prorogation case. You're straight from the Supreme Court now. Do you have a clear sense of where it's going?
For me, the central issue is really quite straightforward. It's about the role that Parliament plays in our Constitution. Our Constitution talks about the supremacy of our Parliament, recognising that it is the sort of centrepiece of our Constitution. It's our centrepiece because it's elected from an electorate of sort of 46 million people. So it has a legitimacy that the judges don't have and that Boris Johnson, elected by an electorate of 160,000, doesn't have. And the government's position is really, really striking. What the government says is, notwithstanding that Parliament can't control whether it's prorogued, the courts can't control it either. It's, to use the legal, it's non-justiciable. And the consequences of that position are really, really stark. The consequence is that if, for example, Richard Tice said to Boris Johnson, I'll pay you 100 million quid if you suspend Parliament for the next 4 years, and Boris Johnson said, all right, sounds like a good deal, and suspended Parliament for 4 years, Parliament could not do anything about it, and the courts would not get involved either. That is a striking proposition, and it cannot be right. That's how I see it anyway.
So is the argument then that really the way the government has defended the case undermines the case? If they had defended it in a slightly different way, would you be less confident of victory?
So there are sort of two limbs to the argument that we run, that we need to run to win. And those two limbs are firstly that it is justiciable, in other words, that it is territory into which judges can enter. It's not, you know, there be dragons for lawyers. And then the second limb of the argument is that the government had a bad motive, an improper motive for suspending Parliament. And the difficulty that the government has in relation to the second limb is that even the dogs in the streets know that the reason why Parliament was suspended is because Boris Johnson did not want it interfering with his plans for Brexit. So what are they going to say about that? They have to go instead and go hard on their first point, which is this point about justiciability. And that also has very, very unattractive consequences if you're the Supreme Court.
And so
Wasn't there the suggestion, do I remember rightly, at one point, I think I saw on Barrister's Twitter, that you're a prominent member of this fraternity, that Johnson was asked to be a witness in this case? Have I understood that right? And so there was the prospect of you cross-examining him, potentially.
Yeah, so way back in July we started this case because we saw prorogation coming. And we went along to court and we said, look, if the government's going to say it has a proper motive for suspending Parliament, it needs to give that explanation. It needs to give that explanation in an affidavit. And if it lies in an affidavit, of course, it's in contempt of court and the author of that affidavit can go to prison. And that affidavit should come from the person who made the decision to prorogue, which is Boris Johnson. So we put that card on the table. We can't compel the production of an affidavit from the Prime Minister, but we said this is what the government should do if they want to run this argument. And I had a lot of fun over August encouraging people on Twitter to put pressure on Boris Johnson to swear an affidavit, because I knew that he could not do it. I mean, you know, this stuff doesn't really do anything. I suppose it builds a sense of camaraderie amongst those of us who think we're fighting the good fight on this question. And, you know, we got 10,000 people tweeting about that. it was consciousness raising, if you like.
I mean, I suppose what's interesting is the government, they have lawyers, right? They have minds on this. Is it a surprise to you that they would go in with something so weak, or do you think it indicates something worse?
I think it indicates something worse. So there is a really ugly backstory to all of this. Let me just give you some known facts. So earlier in the year, Jacob Rees-Mogg wrote an article about prorogation, saying that it would be a good way to, in essence, do the Brexit. And that's a fact. In June, Nicky da Costa, who's the Prime Minister's advisor on legislative matters, wrote a blog for The Spectator saying more or less the same thing. What we then had was Jacob Rees-Mogg going to see the Queen and telling her that the reason for the prorogation was a good reason, and although we don't know exactly what the content was of that conversation, we assume he followed the line that the reason for the prorogation was to enable Boris Johnson to deliver his, in inverted commas, exciting new domestic agenda.
When was that, sorry? When did Jacob Rees-Mogg go and see
that? That was on the 28th of August.
Okay, so this is...
So very recently.
Yeah.
And then we had disclosed to us in the Scottish case some documents which were Nicky da Costa's memo to Boris Johnson saying you should prorogue because you have an exciting domestic agenda, and Boris Johnson saying, you know, hot dog, I'll do that. That was the famous handwritten memo in which he referred to David Cameron as being a girly swat, and he talked about the rigmarole of Parliament. And alongside that Nicky da Costa memo and the Boris Johnson response, there are heavily rumoured to be, we don't know for a fact, conversations between a whole bunch of people, all of whom were named by Dominic Grieve in Parliament the other day in his humble address.
And just to be clear, this was the bit of legislation that compelled Cummings and other senior staff to release text messages, WhatsApp, private emails, etc., relating to prorogation. And this was passed, if I'm right in thinking, that this was passed by a slender majority in the House of Commons.
The ayes to the right, 311. The noes to the left, 302.
What is thought to have happened is that some or all of those people named by Dominic Grieve had WhatsApp groups, Signal messages on burner phones. A burner phone is a phone that you buy for cash. It's a cheap phone. You use it to send illicit messages that you don't want to be traceable to you under any circumstances.
So the cabinet are using burner phones to discuss Brexit, and that's come out in this case.
So, no, we can't go that far.
Okay.
What we believe to have happened is that some or all of those people named by Dominic Grieve may have been communicating using, as I say, Signal or WhatsApp or private email, and are said to have communicated on burner phones about the real reasons for the prorogation.
Right.
So the idea is this, that you have this conversation taking place in the background, which was the real conversation, planning the suspension of Parliament. And then you have this anodyne memo prepared by Nicky DaCosta sent to Boris Johnson, in which some, in inverted commas, good reason is presented to Boris Johnson for suspending Parliament, which he then immediately does. It's pretty striking. I think Nicky DaCosta's memo is signed on the same day as Boris Johnson's answer. So, you know, there's a, even just looking at the dates, there's a slight sense of it all being pre-planned, if you like. And I've said on the record, I've had to say it again now, that I don't believe that that memo and that answer represent the real reason for the prorogation. I think it's window dressing. Another fact, the Nicky DaCosta memo and the Boris Johnson handwritten response were dumped on us very, very late in the evening, about 11 o'clock, the night before we went into court. And they were dumped without any explanatory statement, an affidavit, a witness statement from somebody able to explain the story. And this information I've got from a very, very good source, I can't tell you who that source is, but a very, very good source in a position to know who's proven accurate about stuff that's been completely out with market knowledge. And what that source tells me is that a witness statement was prepared by the government legal service and was given to two people in a position to swear as to the truth of why Parliament was prorogued. And the names that have been mentioned, I do not say they are right, but these are the names that have been mentioned, Nicky DaCosta and the Cabinet Secretary. And both of them refused to sign that witness statement. And so the government, in a sense, was hoist by its own petard. It wasn't in a position to lead the evidence that it needed to lead to back up its case that this was prorogation for a proper purpose, because either of those two people, if the rumours are right, if the information that I have from a reliable source is right, both of those people couldn't sign the witness statements, because to sign the witness statements would have been perjuring themselves.
Well.
Wow. And so nobody in Cabinet could sign them?
So they couldn't find... So this is... this may explain why the stuff came so late. You know, you expect government, because it's not a very nice litigant, it should be, but it isn't. You expect government to dump stuff on you late. You don't quite expect it to get as late as 11 o'clock, because, you know, that does look bad even to a pretty cynical judge. And, I mean, when I think about the story to myself, what I imagine happened is that they sent the stuff over to these two individuals to sign, you know, maybe late afternoon. And then they had a bit of a panic because they couldn't get the signatories to those witness statements to sign them. And then they began to wonder how on earth they were going to defend their position.
Wow.
And so it may well be, in fact, I suspect it's true to say, that they wanted to run a case on them having a proper motive, but they were unable to do so.
Wow.
Because the people they were relying upon to make that case weren't prepared to put forward the evidence.
Oh, it's amazing. I didn't know that.
We've got a strong sense of self-preservation, tourists.
Well, everybody does, though. I mean, you don't sign
a
false
statement
lightly, do you? Not even I would sign a false statement lightly. Was that before the Scottish case or before the England case?
So the documents all came out in the Scottish case.
Right, OK.
And initially, the government was refusing to allow them to be published, so we just read large chunks of them into the transcript. And then the BBC and the Times and the Scottish Sun turned up in court and made an application for the documents to be disclosed in full, and the inner house of the Court of Session, Scotland's highest court, acceded to that application and allowed the material in its entirety to be put into the public domain. What we later learned was that the words that the government legal service, we assume, had scrubbed out of Boris Johnson's memo were the words in which David Cameron was referred to as that girly swat.
It's amazing that that's the bit he's most embarrassed about.
Well, I'm awfully cynical these days. I wish I wasn't, but I am. And although my information is that that was a genuine leak, I do kind of wonder how Boris Johnson feels about being positioned as the man who described David Cameron as a girly swot. Is that bad for Boris Johnson or is that good for Boris Johnson? Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah.
I suppose that moves us on to the wider context around the case. So how important is it? Is it an interesting legal and constitutional exercise, or is it actually important to the Brexit process now that no deal has been taken off the table by Parliament with the legislation rushed through, etc., before prorogation took place?
Well, it's important for both. Let me deal with the Brexit question first, and I'll come on to the general question. So far as the Brexit question is concerned, we are not yet through the woods. So on Sunday morning at about 2 o'clock, because I'm not sleeping much at the moment, I wrote a blog about a loophole in the Benn Act, and that's now been read well in excess of 100,000 times on a weird point of statutory construction. And what it explains is that there is a way, unless MPs are very smart, for Boris Johnson to secure that he does not have to ask the EU for an extension. And it seems to me that his ability to deliver no deal continues to exist, that if, as is heavily rumoured, and again I know this from a good quality information, let me put it in that way, that Number 10 is planning a further prorogation, and if that prorogation happens, Boris Johnson's ability to deliver no deal will be enhanced. It's really, really, really difficult for me to see how Boris Johnson can meet his constantly iterated promise that we will leave the EU on the 31st of October unless his plan is to leave with no deal, because there is just not time to take all of the steps that needs to be taken between now and the 31st of October to avoid no deal. There are a lot of steps that are written into our primary legislation that have to be taken before the deal can be formalised. And on the EU side too, Parliament has to approve that deal. And then after Parliament has approved it, the Council needs to approve it by a qualified majority vote.
So what, the EU Council? So they would have to approve it on the 17th, so it needs to be approved by Parliament before the 17th.
Parliament, right. Well, the sequence of events that we're assuming is this, and we're here in a world that many of us believe to be a make-believe world, which is a world where we assume that negotiations are taking place between the Prime Minister or his team and the EU27 and their negotiator. Let's assume those negotiations are happening, and let's assume that they arrive at an agreement. That agreement will need to be signed off by the Council, and the Council is meeting on the 17th and 18th of October. So what we then assume will happen is that on the 19th of October, a Saturday, by the way, on the 19th of October, Boris Johnson will say to Parliament, here is a withdrawal agreement which I invite you to sign. And from that date, the 19th of October, there is an awful lot that needs to happen, some of it sequentially, before no deal can be avoided. That's true as a matter of UK law. And there is an awful lot that needs to happen on the EU side as a matter of EU law before it can formalise that hypothetical new withdrawal agreement. And I do not believe, and I'm really clear in my own mind about this, I do not believe there is time for that to happen between the 19th of October and the 31st of October. So it seems to me that either we don't leave on the 31st of October, or if we do leave on the 31st of October, we leave with no deal. I cannot imagine that we will leave on the 31st of October with a deal, because I just don't think there's time.
And to be really clear on the and no deal legislation, it says by the 18th of October, is that right, that Boris Johnson is instructed to send a letter requesting an extension?
So if Boris Johnson has not got the approval of Parliament to a deal, or indeed to no deal, by the end of the 19th of October,
19th, yep.
He is obliged to send a letter to the council asking for an extension.
And what's the loophole in layman's terms?
The loophole is that he might send that letter and then prorogue Parliament again, such that all of those steps that are written into our law as preconditions for that withdrawal agreement being formalised in UK law cannot be met. And if you stop to think about it for a second, if you ask yourself the question, how is he going to get that withdrawal agreement through Parliament, given what the ERG has said in the past and given what we know about the increased dissolution of the Conservative Party, it's really not that hard to imagine him saying to the ERG, look, if you guys vote for the withdrawal agreement on the 19th of October, I can deliver no deal to you.
I see. Okay. I've got there, finally. So actually what we need is for MPs to know not to vote for the withdrawal agreement, which I was going to tell them not to anyway.
That's right. So there are two ways in which this trap is avoided. One of the ways in which the trap is avoided is if Boris Johnson doesn't have a withdrawal agreement to put before Parliament at all. Another way for the trap to be avoided is for MPs not to approve any withdrawal agreement until after the extension has been agreed.
But surely there are a good number of MPs who don't want the withdrawal agreement anyway. I'm just thinking, if one of the ways to avoid it, if the only way that the loophole, as you say, could be utilised by a Prime Minister who wanted no deal is for a load of MPs to bung him their votes for the withdrawal agreement, I don't see how they would have done that anyway, because this is going
to
be...
This is a great argument for getting people to vote against the withdrawal agreement.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it'll be very difficult for Labour MPs who are keen to back a May deal Mark II to back it without the extension being secured. So on the political level, does this scenario mean that all paths lead back to the government of national unity? And also, to add another question onto this, on the legal level, couldn't the Supreme Court turn around and say, if Parliament does not like the prorogation, it is within their power to just no confidence the administration, and use that as an argument to say, well, look, nothing to see here. Parliament is still sovereign and can still control the executive.
It's certainly true to say that one of the ways in which you might, as a parliament, prevent yourself from being suspended is to remove the Prime Minister that you know plans to suspend you. But there are a lot of difficulties with that proposition. The most serious difficulty is that Parliament doesn't get or needn't have advance warning of its suspension.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time looking at this on Saturday, and there is no need for prorogation to be prospective. It could take place, you know, right away. Of course, there's also the political reality, which is that in normal circumstances, if we can call them those, where you have a majority government, It's really quite difficult for MPs in political reality to remove a Prime Minister who wants to suspend Parliament. That just doesn't reflect what politics is actually like. So I don't think that those arguments on analysis do give to Parliament a way of controlling whether or not the Prime Minister suspends it. The other aspect to this is the political aspect, and that too is really quite important and really quite interesting. And I speak to lots of politicians from lots of different political parties. I mean, all of them really. I don't think I've spoken to the DUP, but I speak to pretty much everyone else. And I mean, I understand that one of the consequences of the suspension of Parliament has been to really focus people's minds in Parliament, and that discussions which had been thought to be stale about an emergency government replacing Boris Johnson are now live again. So, I mean, these discussions are taking place, and it may be that they have two cracks at replacing Boris Johnson, first of all, with Jeremy Corbyn, and second of all, if they can't get a majority for that, with somebody else, somebody who is more politically palatable across the political spectrum. And, I mean, I just today commissioned advice from a leading constitutional lawyer, I won't name her, on the question whether you need to have a vote of no confidence in the government under the Fixed Term Parliament Act to replace the Prime Minister. Because, of course, one of the things that's made MPs wary about adopting that course has been the fact that if they vote no confidence in the PM and then they can't get a replacement leader in post within 14 days, Parliament is suspended with a general election, and that might very well deliver the no deal that they're fighting to avoid.
And to go back, but also to go forward, to go back to something you were saying earlier about it being a make-believe world in which Boris is seriously negotiating and planning a deal, do you think, how much of this do you think is theatre, and how much of it do you think is a genuine authoritarian purpose? A man who genuinely does want no deal, who does want to wreak havoc and destruction on the country, and who would happily suspend Parliament for 4 years?
And I think that's really a question about how long Dominic Cummings plans to stay or is expected to stay, because he is a sort of a deeply destructive force that is now operating right at the heart of government. But the thing is, once you taste autocratic executive power, you know, you might discover that you really rather like it. So even those who remember a Boris Johnson as Mayor of London, who they imagine to be what we fondly called a one-nation conservative, fundamentally liberal, centre-right rather than autocratic, should be concerned about whether he'll be able to let go of that unbridled power that comes with suspending Parliament. And the other thing that's really, really remarkable is the pace at which our constitution is deteriorating. So 3 months ago, if anyone had suggested that we were going to be in a world in which Parliament had been suspended by the Prime Minister to get it out of the way, you know, you would have been laughed at. Now we are being drip-fed the idea of a further prorogation as soon as this one finishes. And we have a Prime Minister who is very, very clear that we will leave on the 31st of October, even if it is unlawful for him so to do.
And the willingness to do that, of course, seems to be at the absolute heart of the crisis in the Conservative Party at the moment.
He can't ignore the law. The Prime Minister is subject to the law of the land and the rule of law, like just like anybody else. If he were to attempt to ignore it, the government would be taken to court and he would be ordered to to send the letter, and if he didn't send the letter, he would be sent to prison for contempt.
That is really, really alarming stuff. So I was talking about this the other day. A question was put to me, you know, how do we remake our constitution at the moment, Jerry? You know, do we need to codify it or what? And I said, look, at the moment, the height of my ambition is to slow the pace of constitutional deterioration. I'm really pretty pessimistic.
Are you? And are you pessimistic about the outcome of Brexit in terms of deal, withdrawal agreement, no deal?
No. I've always believed that Remain was at least as likely as any other outcome. And I still believe that now. But I can simultaneously hold that belief and also hold the belief that the road back to the really boring stuff that lawyers care about, good governance, trust in institutions, a functioning body politic, a country that shares some level of common purpose, people who see some type of kind of social unity, that the road back to that is a long and difficult road.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. Unfortunately, due to a technical fault in the recording process, there's no extra time on today's show. We're sorry about that. Usually paid-up members of Another Europe is possible receive access to additional material on the podcast. We'd still encourage you to join and support the campaign, of course. To do so, you can go to anothereurope.org/join. And if you're not able to join, but would still like to support us, you can. Just take a minute to leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. Or if you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your friends, family, and on social media. We'll be back very soon. See you then.